This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Most people consider Illinois a blue state, given its voting history, but not State Senator Bill Brady.
This state is a swing state, and given the national challenges in parts of the state, it put Governor Rauner at a disadvantage.
Brady talks with GLT's Ryan Denham about GOP lessons learned from the political campaign and what's next for the General Assembly. Plus, Mary Cullen reports on the opioid crisis and how Chestnut Health Systems is trying to better coordinate service for addicts. Eric Stock takes a look at the new makeup of the McLean County Board, and Mayor Chris Koos of Normal drops by to talk city council races, community development, and the changing state political landscape. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The town of Normal has moved ahead on a tax levy and is seeking input on how to use community development block grant money. Joining us to talk about those and other developments is Mayor Chris Koos of Normal. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. The tax levy could result in a slightly lower tax bill for the putative average homeowner, about $7 less of a tax bill because of marginally rising property values. The town has historically viewed property tax rates as something to be held steady while revenue growth depends on sales taxes. This acknowledges both school district's dependence on property taxes as its primary source of money and the historic pattern of sales tax growth. That history, though, has changed. Sales taxes have been flat to falling for a few years now. Would the town ever reconsider this philosophical stance on property taxes?
Well, you know, Charlie, it's something we visit every year, whether in retreat or in budget hearings. We talk about that. You know, when I came on council, I think in 2001, I think it was in 2002, that we had made the decision that we would do a flat levy, which we have done, to fund police and fire pensions. And we take a little bit of it for the general fund, but not very much. And we've held steadfast to that. As you mentioned, you know, in deference to Unit 5, who really relies on property taxes for their major source of their funding. And, you know, for a lot of years, we had rising EAVs, and that really helped us. And then the recession hit, equalized assessed evaluation dropped, and that caused us to raise some rates. And we're happy to see the rate go down, you know. And as you said, it's about $7 on a $165,000 house. It's not a lot of money, but it's in the right direction.
You're going to be facing, though, in coming years, not this year, because of staff cuts preventing an increase in the pension contributions, but you're going to see an increase in need to make contributions to the pension funds. So that's going to put pressure on that stance and on that decision. Do you think you're going to give on that?
I think we'll talk about it. You know, we'll have to analyze the situation in a year and see where that is. There's a possibility that we will give on that. You know, we're hopeful with a new House majority that people will revive the Marketplace Fairness Act to put sales tax on internet retailers so that those taxes flow to the municipalities in which they're delivered. And that's a big thing for municipalities all over the country.
Have you done work, has the staff done work, an estimate on what that might mean for the town and recapturing things that are not now collected?
It's very difficult to do. You know, we can make a guesstimate. You know, we think it could be $300,000-$400,000 a year in lost revenue.
That's not chump change.
No, it is not.
It's not huge, but it makes a difference.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
The town is going to hold some hearings and get public input on how to spend about, coincidentally, $400,000 a year in community development block grant money from the federal government. Is that a change in the decision-making process going for public hearings?
It will affect the decision-making process. I wouldn't say it's a change, but... you know, we want to hear from the general public if there are things we are missing. You know, currently most of our community block grant dollars go to low interest loan buy downs for first time home buyers. We support Unity Community Center with those dollars and paying the rent for the facility out there. Things like that. There may be other options that we're not seeing.
Is there a longer history? I mean, those are in recent years. You've been doing Unity Community Center and a couple other things, but over the longer period of your life, your public life, what's it been used for?
Mostly that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. There were a couple suggestions: low-income housing and additional basketball and other court use for North mm-hmm. Normal. What do you think of those ideas?
I think they're worth exploring. They certainly are. The gentleman who spoke about recreation in North Normal, I think, had an issue that he saw that we really need to take a look at. Now, whether we use community block grant dollars for that remains to be seen. That's a parks that would be in Parks and Recreation budget, and they may have some flexibility in their budget to address that need if they agree that the need is there.
Yeah, that could be a priority setting exercise within the department each year. So how should the low-income housing is an area-wide issue, and it's even a statewide issue, having a lack of affordable housing. How should the town take up that matter?
Well, you know, that's something we're looking at in terms of we see probably the need greatest in multifamily housing, and part of our Uptown 2.0 plan was to address some of that, to have some lower priced housing. And you know, I've seen in communities all over the country, and this community hasn't warmed up to the idea yet, where developers do a mixture of market rate and subsidized housing in a multifamily unit. And you can't tell the difference between one apartment from the other, but because of tax credits are available in that, they can make that work. And developers have been doing this for years, and it works very well.
It's often a NIMBY issue and not in my backyard issue.
That's very much that.
And how should the town address that head on? Because that's the only way to tackle that sensibility.
I think that's the way we have to address it.
But what do you say? What do you say other than what you've already said, that you know, the housing quality itself is equivalent? It's not going to affect your housing values.
Well, I think what we have to do is prove to people that if a multifamily development has 50 units in it, and 10 of those units are subsidized units, that does not make the whole project subsidized housing, which is how people tend to look at it. It's very black and white in people's minds when they take a NIMBY approach.
Well, part of the NIMBY is a cultural fear as well.
Absolutely.
As a property value fear. Those people kind of fear. They're low income, and that will automatically produce a higher crime rate.
You know, and it's kind of ironic in the sense that, you know, almost all of us at some point in our life were low income, and we're living in what we could afford in terms of multifamily housing. And I think a lot of people that have kind of moved up through the socioeconomic chain have experienced that, and it kind of surprises me that they don't recognize that from their own past.
And the fact that fear is statistically unfounded.
Exactly.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Mayor Chris Koos of the town of Normal. Where do you stand on the legalization of cannabis, since it's likely the state is going to take that up in the next year or two?
You know, I won't. I kind of have to see what the actual landscape is going to look like. But, you know, if we're taking an overarching view, I'm certainly supportive of it. I mean, it's very, very much not different from alcohol. I mean, there are people that are going to abuse drugs. There are people that are going to abuse alcohol. That's just a fact of those substances.
With any legalized vice, some people will use it responsibly, and as you say, some will not. We see that, as you said, with alcohol and with gambling. Mm-hmm. With legalization, though, more people will use than now, and some of them will get into trouble. How should the town get ready for that?
Well, I think, you know, that's going to take a statewide program. And you know, there was talk of that when all the players were lining up for medical marijuana, and they were doing it with a notion that eventually it was going to be recreational marijuana as well, some of the dollars generated for that should be oriented towards substance abuse programs for people that do develop a problem or already have a problem.
Yeah, the problems appear locally, though, and the revenue goes to the state and then trickles down. Has it trickled down?
Mm-hmm. Well, how does it trickle down?
Has it? Has it really been visible?
Oh, no, not at all, because medical marijuana in McLean County barely exists.
Mm-hmm. So gambling was the same thing. There was money supposedly set aside for to address the problems created by addictive gambling. Has the town seen that?
No.
The trickle down.
It's above my pay grade, Charlie.
So why will this be different?
I don't know that it will.
So how should the town cope with the problems that are created locally?
I think the same way we're coping with them now, Charlie. You know, our police currently are, I won't put a percentage on it, but a percentage of their duties is mental health intervention. Because you know, we as a community stepped up to that with the county and the two communities dedicating some funds for mental health intervention and crisis center things. So that's how we've addressed it locally. We have to see what the issue is before we can say this is what we're going to do.
So addiction is addiction, and that's a mental health, that's a symptom.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The slate of candidates for next April's municipal elections is set. We have 8 running for 3 positions. Are you surprised at that number?
Not really. I'm not really surprised at that.
Well,
you know, Jeff Fritzen has been a longtime stalwart member of the council, very important member of the council. And when people like that leave, it creates a little bit of a vacuum.
So you're viewing nobody wanted to take on Jeff Fritzen because he was doing a grand job and because nobody could possibly beat him because of his long incumbency status.
Nobody could possibly beat him because if you look at the election landscape in the last 4 or 5 years, it's been full of surprises.
Okay, so so what else is operating here to produce that many candidates rather than one or two?
Well, I think people have issues that they want to address by running. Some may be single issues. Some may see an opportunity to serve their community. But there's definitely a seat in play, and so it's a little bit of y'all come.
So how about the political philosophies of the candidates as expressed so far? Are there tea leaves that you can read and tell people what's going on with?
Yes.
Well,
no.
You're not going
I'm
to?
I'm not going to share that.
Why not?
It's too early.
Okay. Will you be supporting candidates?
Pardon?
Will you be supporting candidates?
It's too early for me to say that, too. I mean, I certainly, every election cycle, passively support people through my network. A lot of people have asked me if I'm going to endorse certain candidates. I'm not ready to say yes or no to that.
Well, your cohort in Bloomington, Mayor Terry Renner, drew also that distinction between supporting and endorsing and said he will certainly be supporting candidates. How significant will that support take, will that support be for you, even if you do not choose to go the formal endorsement route?
Well, I tell a joke that, you know, if there were a candidate that I wasn't supporting, there were neighborhoods I could identify that I would walk for that candidate because I don't do well in those neighborhoods.
Okay. Addition through subtraction. Got it. So the the take from Mayor Renner was that no mayor worth his or her salt should avoid supporting and showing strong support. It's a way of showing leadership. It's a way of trying to enforce your own views or encourage your own views to be represented on the council. Mm-hmm. How do you see that playing out?
And I think Terry would probably agree with me on this, but, you're looking at the council and the community as a whole. If there's somebody that you don't particularly agree with, but you respect their opinion and how they got to their opinion and their position in the community, it's not important that you have a council in lockstep. In fact, too much of that can be bad for a community. So the idea that there might be somebody that's coming up that's new, that has different opinions, strongly held opinions that you don't agree with, but yet you respect how they got there. Why not let that person rise to the council?
At least one candidate is making that argument that he sees too much of a council that votes in lockstep on big issues. Do you agree with that?
I don't. I don't agree with that. On some more significant issues, there's often a 5-2 vote. There's rarely 4-3 votes. But people have to understand, part of a mayor's job is if I see something that wants to come forward for the council and I reach out to my council members and talk to them and I see there's no support for it, why bring that forward? If it's not going to pass, why bring it to the table?
Well, because that is a demonstration that you're listening and testing a lot of different ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it's a time waster in public, but isn't part of your job to do that in public, is, I guess, the argument from these other candidates.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, if people want to know why that hasn't come forward, yeah, absolutely. The ability to have a conversation one-on-one with somebody and test the winds or get a recommendation from staff that, hey, we can't do that right now.
Is there
just for the efficiency of a part-time mayor who's not, we just.
Is there a deleterious effect on civility and the ability to have a public dialogue and discourse in a civil way? Eroded by testing everything with a vote.
No.
So that's not a factor.
I don't see that. I mean, I've seen some spirited discussions on our council in disagreement, and when that when everybody leaves the table, everybody's back to collegial and actually making jokes at each other about how they voted. And the current council has had that ability to disagree. To strongly disagree, but not take it personally.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mayor Chris Koos is our guest today. Let's move to the state level. The state political landscape is changing with the coming inauguration of a new governor. How do you see that affecting cities and towns and their interests?
Well, I'm hopeful that what will change is the fact that we get a strong capital bill and start reinvesting in infrastructure in our state. I think that's going to be, people talk about job growth and things like that. Infrastructure is a piece of that. If you have solid infrastructure in a community, businesses will be attracted to the state. I'm not going to get into the tax discussion. I'm not sure where that's going to fall out, and I don't think we've seen a final plan on that yet.
You mean the graduated income tax proposal?
Yeah, the graduated income tax. There's a lot of state bashing, Illinois state bashing going on, and there are issues in the state of Illinois, serious issues. But, you look at a community like us, and we've recruited manufacturing to this community.
That sector still exists? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, with the promise of up to 2,000 jobs as a result of that, and those are not minimum wage jobs. Those are serious jobs. So, we need to talk more about what we're good at and what we can do as opposed to saying, the state's a mess and what are we going to do? And, oh my, the sky's falling. We have serious problems. There's no question of that. But how do we address those problems at a state level and as a community level is the question.
So we're at the tea leaf reading stage of what's going to happen under a Pritzker administration. One of the ways in which those leaves are read is looking at the makeup of the transition team members. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned an infrastructure bill is something that really could affect positively the town and the city. What do the transition team members give you to gauge that?
I'll ask that in a different way.
So who's on the transition team on the infrastructure piece of this, and what do you think the likelihood is that that will be a good thing for the town?
Well, you know, that remains to be seen. I've heard that a number of utility CEOs are being highly considered for a transition team, not knowing these individuals and how they would react. I would hope that it would be more broad-based, that they would bring some community members in, elected officials at the local level, because the perspective we have on infrastructure may be way different than it is at the state level.
Well, power grid and renewables certainly are a perspective that would be valuable for an infrastructure bill. But that's not roads and bridges.
That's not roads and bridges, no.
So who would you recommend the governor consider for?
Oh, Charlie.
Yeah, okay.
I could recommend all day and not listen to that.
Not going there. Okay. Former Chief Circuit Judge Beth Robb is also on one particular part of the transition team, as is ISU President Larry Dietz.
Mike Tipsord.
Mike Tipsord, State Farm. So
today. What
do those folks tell you about how Pritzker is approaching those pieces of his transition?
I'm happy that those people are there, because they do represent a community. They are very personal representatives of the community and bring those issues to those transition teams.
Mayor Chris Coos, thanks for your time today on Sound Ideas.
Always good to be here.
The mayors of Bloomington and Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Heritage Health Therapy and Senior Care, exclusive providers of Restore Therapy. Restore Therapy, where your rehab and independence mean more. On the web at heritageofcare.com/restore. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Mary Cullen's report on the opioid crisis and how local healthcare officials are trying to deal with it. The Illinois General Assembly has ended its fall session as Democrats anticipate complete control of the state capitol in January. Record Democratic majorities in both houses will watch Democratic Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker be sworn in January 14th. Lawmakers just wrapped up their final veto session under outgoing Governor Bruce Rauner. GLT's Ryan Denham caught up with Republican Bill Brady from Bloomington, the Senate Minority Leader. They started with the failed attempt to override Rauner's veto of a bill raising the minimum age to buy tobacco products to 21. Brady opposed it too.
It was a difficult decision for me. My father passed of lung cancer, so I understand the ill effects. The other problem for me, though, is we have had an age of majority, and I feel that particularly people who put their self in harm's way should have the same freedom and rights as other adults.
So you would have wanted to keep that at 18. So a successful veto override came on legislation raising the damage cap in the Illinois Court of Claims from $100,000 to as much as $2 million. For our listeners, this was inspired in part by the outbreak of Legionnaires' disease at the Quincy Veterans Home. What did you think of that change?
Well, I thought the governor's mandatory veto was well put. The fact that maybe an adjustment needed to occur upward to be more in line with awards, but the limit that the initial sponsor put on was, I thought, far-reaching. And although I'm very empathetic to all the folks who have suffered, I felt that the governor's veto was a better alternative, or a mandatory veto.
Let's pivot to the future. Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker will be sworn in on January 14th. So, Senator Brady, how would you characterize the Senate Republican caucus's willingness to work with Pritzker over the next 4 years?
Well, listen, Illinois needs all the help it can get. We've got a great state, but we've underperformed, and the people of Illinois deserve cooperation. I'm going to do everything I can to lead the Senate Republican caucus into cooperating on issues that will move this state forward. There will, of course, will be some differences of opinion about what moves our state forward. I had a very nice conversation with Governor-elect Pritzker the other day, and we talked about some issues and got to know each other a little better, and he realizes there are issues like increasing taxes on families and businesses that I can't support because I think they don't move Illinois forward. They're more destructive than positive. But there are other issues like an infrastructure program that creates a safer environment on our roads and our bridges, that invests in a better transit ability and also creates jobs that I think we can work together on.
Well, from your perspective, what should a capital bill focused on infrastructure look like? What would be some of your priorities?
Well, the first priority is our roads and bridges. These are areas that if we don't make a significant investment in, we will be put in a position where we can't repair, but we will have to destruct and reconstruct, which is a much, much heavier price tag. Then you get into areas that would benefit places like ISU, a fine arts building that would help make ISU competitive and meet the challenges that they face in meeting today's students' needs. So there are vertical capital priorities as well. The first priority for me is the infrastructure we have and the safety of that infrastructure and the ability it provides for Illinois to be an economic conduit to growth.
Well, other than infrastructure, are there other issues that you think the Senate Republican caucus and the new administration might be able to work together pretty effectively on?
Sure. I had a very positive conversation with Governor Pritzker, and as in the past with Senator Colton and Speaker Madigan, about what we can do to enhance the workplace environment. I'm hoping we can work together on property tax relief. But there are a whole host of issues that I think Republicans, and I think the Democrats would admit, that by Republicans and Democrats working together over the last several years, there were better things that came out than if the Democrats just would have passed their own budget. So I believe the same thing with Governor-elect Pritzker. So we're going to work together, whether we support the end product or not. We're going to give our input on the positives and the negatives we see in specific legislation.
Well, one specific piece of legislation that might come up in 2019 is the legalization of recreational marijuana. What do you think of that idea, and what are some of the issues kind of tied up within that you would like to see fleshed out if it were to come to fruition?
Well, I think you're going to find that there are Republicans who may be open to legalizing recreational marijuana and can play a role in helping make that issue better than if they weren't involved. I'm not quite there. I have grave concerns about the effects this has on our population, but we will see how that moves forward. I don't know how firm Governor Pritzker is with his agenda on that. That remains to be seen. Certainly something that was talked about in the campaign. I have concerns about it, as does I think anybody who even supports it in concept has concerns about how it would be done, and those concerns need to be fleshed out. I hope that law enforcement plays a vital role. I hope the business community plays a vital role. I hope the medical community plays a role in the process, that if, in fact, Illinois moves toward that, that we do it in the best way possible. I'm just not of the opinion we're there right now.
What's one or two of your concerns on legalization of marijuana?
Well, it's a very, very, shall we say, an intense drug, I believe, and the effects it's had as the drug has advanced, in my opinion, from the days when I was in high school or college to how strong that is today, and the effects it has on workplace environment, on abuse, and healthcare effects it has on someone.
Well, another topic that may come up in 2019 is a possibility of a new funding formula for higher education. This is something I've talked to some of your Republican colleagues in the House about, like Dan Brady. Obviously, he is part of this working group that is working on a new funding formula. What do you think about this possibility of a new funding formula for higher education? Do you think it's needed, or are there other things that maybe take a higher priority when it comes to higher ed in Illinois?
Well, I think we need to take a higher priority for higher education. Blagojevich began the downfall of funding for higher education. I think there's more that needs to be done to keep Illinois high school students in Illinois and invested in our areas of higher education. One of my lead people on this, as part of my leadership, is Senator Chapin Rose, who's worked with Representative Dan Brady and others. Jason Bergman obviously has a vested interest in that. He represents Illinois State University's campus. So he's an important part of that to me. But I think we need to look at the overall infrastructure of higher education, the community college system, even the high schools, the baccalaureate, the graduate, and the doctoral programs, and make sure that we're maximizing those resources and those opportunities to the best advantage of our students and to the best advantage of the economic opportunities that they can provide for our state.
So Governor-elect Pritzker will be the governor when the next census occurs and the subsequent redistricting efforts that take place after that new tally of Illinoisans. So redistricting will certainly be coming up here in the years ahead. The Governor-elect Pritzker has in the past signaled an openness to an independent commission approach to drawing maps as opposed to lawmakers themselves. Do you see that as a realistic thing that could happen? That I'm sure a guy like you is supportive of a more nonpartisan approach to political map drawing. The governor may be as well. Do you think that can actually change over the next few years?
That's a great question. I appreciate Governor Pritzker's leadership on moving this issue, as did President Obama, I believe. I'm hopeful that he will push forward on that. Now, in the short run, it may look like it's best for the Democrats to maintain the status quo, but I think in the long run, Illinois would be better off under fair maps. And this will be an issue that we certainly will try to put at the forefront as we have an opportunity in 2022 to draw a map that isn't dictated by the President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House, but would be fair and take into considerations not the political fallout of the members, but the representation of the citizens.
Well, that is obviously focused on future elections, but I did want to ask one question about the election we just saw here in Illinois. What do you think that the Illinois Republican Party should take away from Governor Rauner's loss to J.B. Pritzker? Are there any lessons to be learned of value moving forward?
Well, I would say Illinois was challenged in some parts of the state by what was going on in Washington, D.C., as we saw some fallout in the congressional races. I would, clearly this state is a swing state, and given the national challenges in parts of the state, it put Governor Rauner at a disadvantage that he wasn't at when he was first elected.
Yeah, what do you mean by these kind of challenges out of D.C.?
Well, I mean, where there are parts of this state where Donald Trump is loved, and there are other parts where he is not. I was reading an article about Colorado recently in the race out there. But we were also affected in Illinois by a tremendous spending of resources by Governor Pritzker. I mean, I read reports where he spent over $180 million. If that's true, that's, you know, greater than a 3-to-1 margin over Governor Rauner. That's a hard thing to overcome in a swing state like Illinois.
That's State Senator Bill Brady, Republican from Bloomington. He is the minority leader in the Illinois Senate. I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find our latest news from Springfield on the Illinois page at our website, WGLT.org. Just look for State News on the news dropdown. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Listener-supported public media for Bloomington Normal.
Here we are again asking for money to support this public radio station. You might ask, what have we done lately? Well, some GLT contributing listeners have been paying attention.
Covering local news on air and online.
Traveling to Michigan and LA to cover Rivian Automotive.
Adding even more NPR news and information programs.
I'm contributing listener Letitia Baker. Join me in financially supporting GLT.
Learn more about listener-supported radio, our upcoming fund drive, and contribute at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from UIS Performing Arts Center, presenting a one-night-only performance by Celtic Woman for the Best of Christmas Symphony Tour, Thursday, December 20th at 7:30. Tickets available now at UISPAC.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, new county board members are sworn in McLean County. And Eric Stock takes a look at their possible impact on the board. As the national opioid epidemic continues, representatives from the medical treatment and insurance fields met in Bloomington to talk about more collaboration to care for addicts and prevent addiction. GLT's Mary Cullen reports on a recent roundtable discussion of what effective treatment means and what it does not.
24 people have died from opioids in McLean County so far this year, most by accidental overdose. That's according to Chestnut Health System's CEO, Dave Sherrar. This year, Chestnut admitted 800 adults and adolescents for opioid use. Nearly 20% identified prescription opioids as their primary drug of choice. The remaining 80% named heroin as their primary drug. Sherrar says many heroin users start out using prescription medication, but migrate to heroin after the prescription runs out. Dr. John Wieland is a general surgeon with Integrated Surgical Specialists.
I was part of the problem, and I am now trying to be part of the solution in terms of this opioid crisis that we face in the country today.
A 2016 Health and Human Services statistic shows that 11.5 million people misuse or abuse prescription opioids, causing an average of 116 deaths a day nationwide.
We are obviously in a crisis. It's been called an epidemic. And I think that that's probably legitimate.
Wieland says the drug industry is to blame for aggressive marketing of synthetic opioids, but he says opioid prescribing doctors also hold some responsibility for the epidemic.
We started out with noble intentions. We wanted to cure pain instead of manage pain.
Wieland says early research showed cheaply made synthetic narcotics were less addictive, but data in the late 20th century misjudged the implications of overprescribing opioids.
At the time, they called pain the fifth vital sign. And even though many physicians disputed this, it became a metric by which some physicians were actually judged by and performance measured. And still today, we're trying to extricate ourselves from that.
Included in that, Wieland says, is changing how physicians use patient satisfaction surveys. So what are doctors doing to combat the already rampant opioid crisis? Wieland says the number one goal is obvious: prescribe fewer opioids. Illinois passed a law in 2014 requiring handwritten and signed opioid prescription orders. Wieland says this law created a barrier to access that proved helpful. It was no longer as simple as calling the doctor and asking them to put in a refill. He says the law also led to more prescription prescription monitoring programs, which drew attention to polypharmacy problems, or patients who utilized multiple opioid prescribers without providers knowing. Now, Whelan says doctors are better at acknowledging that pain is subjective. People rate it differently, he says, which means prescribing pain medication is not one size fits all.
Pain is not a vital sign. It cannot be objectively measured. And so therefore, each patient has to be treated on their own level.
He says doctors are going back to prescribing pre-narcotic medicines for pain, like acetaminophen and non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Or in some cases, Whelan says, not using drug treatment at all and prescribing massages, acupuncture, biofeedback, or even yoga. Illinois Department of Insurance's Regional Outreach Coordinator Carol West says a major change in opioid treatment coverage promotes those alternative treatment methods. In 2020, Illinois will be the only state in the nation to change its benchmark plan. West says a benchmark plan is what all other insurance plans are based off of in the state, including the base benefits package. West says the change will mandate coverage for alternative pain therapies like those mentioned by Dr. Wieland. She says those who have not taken opioids before will benefit greatly.
The limit on opioid prescriptions for acute pain mostly talks to the opiate naive.
So those experiencing pain somewhere between 3 to 6 months. She says this change requires the insurance agency to give anyone prescribed 50 milligrams or higher of an opioid at least one reversal agent nasal spray to prevent overdoses. Since starting medical practice in the early 1990s, Dr. Whelan says he has cut his opioid prescriptions by about 75%.
Which is not a boast. It's almost a little embarrassing to admit that, to realize it, because that means that I was over-prescribing that amount for patients.
He says the average number of pain pills that one of his post-operative patients use is 10, but his routine prescription used to be about 30 pills. Now, Whelan says it's doctors' collective role to educate patients on the risks of dependency when prescribing opioids.
You know, most patients that have routine surgery don't have a goal of becoming an opioid addict.
He says doctors need to be aware of that and treat addictive behavior as the symptom it is, and not just shun those who are opioid dependent. Even with doctors like Whelan prescribing fewer opioids, some still become addicted and seek help at treatment centers like Chestnut Health Systems. Brian Hinman is the court treatment coordinator at Chestnut. He says there are negative perceptions of addiction treatment that are simply not true. Hinman says caregivers treat people with compassion rather than viewing treatment facilities like a prison. Clients are not in lockdown and have varying degrees of freedom. He says a residential crisis detox, for example, lasts 5 to 7 days. That allows clients to get opioids out of their system and introduce them to mental health support services.
Treatment's collaborative. It starts with the client, what their needs are, what they think is important, and create some structure there. And it's not so much authoritative as more of, again, collaborative.
Hinman says creating structure in the former addict's life is not always easy, but it can set patients up for a productive life outside of the facility. I'm Mary Cullen.
Chestnut Healthcare started in the early 1970s as an alternative to jail for individuals with public intoxication. It has since expanded to multiple service lines with an estimated 700 employees throughout McLean County, Southwest Illinois, and other places. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. So much news, so little time, but you'll never miss a thing when you sign up for GLT's Scoop. You can learn more at WGLT.org. Our e-newsletter delivers you just the good stuff, our biggest stories, first dibs on GLT events, and a heads up about upcoming NPR specials. Sign up for an email you'll actually want to read. Subscribe now at WGLT.org/email. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The McLean County Board looks much different today than it did a few days ago, with a swearing-in of six new members. Four of them are women. Until yesterday, only three of the board's 20 members were female. GLT's Eric Stock talks with new board members Shana Wachinski, Lindsay Bloomfield, Elizabeth Johnston, and Sharon Chung about the changing demographics of the board and how they already helped champion a measure to move the governing body's monthly meeting times to the evening. It became an issue in the recent campaign, with supporters saying it will enable more people to attend the meetings. We begin with Wachinski.
I think it's great. I think that's a perfect example of elections matter. I don't know if we would have been at this place had the new members not been coming in. So even though people in the past have supported it, I think it was the election and seeing what the constituents wanted that really pushed this across the finish line. I'm very excited about it.
And Lindsay Bloomfield, your reaction to the times being changed, you also had voted for it.
Yeah, thank you. I think this is just proof positive of how fantastic John McIntyre is at leading a bipartisan team. What we're seeing here is true transparency, and I'm excited to partner with everybody on the board in making this a more transparent community.
And Elizabeth Johnston.
Well, I'm actually really glad. This was an issue. They keep saying that it was our campaign issue. It was not typically, actually from the beginning, it was not one of my campaign issues, but it became a constituent issue. And so as I was talking to people, they became very concerned about this issue. They wanted to see the times changed, and I'm glad to see that the board all stepped up to support that.
And Sharon Chung.
Yes, I'm really happy. It was a unanimous decision. That's very different from how it was 2 years ago. I think it really is a case of the new candidates that came in. We're really pushing this issue and really pushing other members who had voted against in the past that we can do better.
As the county board swears in with six new members, obviously it's a much different looking county board than it was before with the four of you and also a 19-year-old new to the county board. You had six older men, all white, leaving. What does this do for the diversity of the county board, and what impact does that make for the average McLean County resident, Shana?
I think, obviously, we've changed the diversity of the board just in being who we are. But I think it's really important for people, when they look at their government, local government, state government, federal government, that they see themselves in the people that are representing them. It helps them to feel that they're not separated from what's like government's not happening to them, that they're a part of it. So I think that's really important.
And Lindsay?
Sure. I'm so excited that we have an elected group of folks who really are representative of the people, the communities in the greater McLean County.
And Lizzie?
So one of the things that they talk about whenever new people come on the board is they do bring new ideas, a new focus. And one of the things that I have focused on in my campaign and I will continue to do as a member of the board now is continuing access and educating the voters. So many people, this is just something that they're not familiar with, and they've really appreciated what I've done to make sure that they have better access, that they know what's happening, and I will continue that and try to bring in more input as much as I can from the constituents, making sure that the board is heading in the direction that they want it to.
And Sharon.
I think it's a really wonderful thing. Right now, when you look at the board, the board now definitely is more representative of how our county actually looks, and I think that also it just goes to show that if you have a passion for talking to people, if you have a passion to learn facts, that you can do this too. I'm a working mother. Many of us here are working mothers, and we actually have as much of a right to bring our voices to the table as anybody else.
And each of you is just one of 20 members on this board, and there is a lot of experience on this board. The more veteran members get the more plum committee assignments, etc. How do you look to make an impact in your first term with sort of that headwind working against you, starting with you, Shana?
Well, I think the most important thing is getting in and learning as much as we can and building relationships with the people on the committees with us and the people on the board with us. We do have a lot to learn, but that's also going to involve listening to our constituents and, bringing issues to them and asking their opinions on it as well. So.
And Lindsay, how do you look to make an impact here in your first term?
Sure. Well, thanks to Chairman McIntyre, we're actually really well situated. As you look at the different counties surrounding us, McLean County is a standout. We're going to continue to be so. I hope to bring personally a diversity of thought to the Land Use and Development Committee as well as the Property Committee and keep things going on the right track.
And Lizzie?
I think this gives us an opportunity to show constituents the best way to access the committees. Even if it's not a committee that we're on, we can still come to it and we can bring ideas, questions, try to bring new directions to those committees, even if we're not unofficially a member. And so I'm hoping that we can show the constituents that they too can do this. This is how it gets done. This is how you bring things up.
Okay. And Sharon, how you look to make an impact?
Well, one of the committees I was just appointed to was the Land Use and Development Committee. There was only one Democrat on that in the past 2 years. So now we have three. And so Shana is on that with me as well. So I think that we can maybe just bring our voices to that committee more, which definitely has trended to be a little more conservative. Also, I'm also really excited to be put on the Health Committee. That was actually one of the first reasons that I actually watched the County Board was in July of 2017, and I spoke at the August 2017 meeting about the need for a mental health coordinator position. And so this is something that's really exciting to me.
That was new McLean County Board member Sharon Chung, along with Elizabeth Johnston, Lindsay Bloomfield, and Shana Wachinski, speaking with CLT's Eric Stock. One of the county board's major tasks in early 2019 will be selecting a new county administrator. Bill Wasson has announced his retirement. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. WGLT.org is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen and Eric Stock. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT on WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.